WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News,
app.
I'm Andy Field. The Pentagon will tighten security controls on classified information access. That move, a direct response to the leak of classified documents on the Discord social media site.
Another thing that you're going to see is new technologies being put in place into some of those secure rooms to basically monitor who is using, who is accessing certain pieces of information in real time.
ABC's Louis Martinez at the Pentagon. Police in Shreveport, Louisiana, searching for the suspect or suspects who started firing during a July 4th block party that killed four people. Councilwoman Tabitha Taylor.
You will not get away with this. What you have done is traumatized this community.
Several others hurt. Law enforcement sources tell ABC News that disturbing online messages believed to have been posted by the Philadelphia mass shooting suspect included statements expressing support for guns, animosity toward liberals, and questions about evil spirits. This is ABC News. JetBlue saying it will not appeal a judge's ruling against its partnership with American Airlines. JetBlue says it will turn its attention to a proposed $3.8 billion purchase of Spirit Airlines. The Rocket Man reaching new heights on his farewell tour.
Elton John says goodbye to the road this weekend, his final stop on his farewell Yellow Brick Road tour, Saturday in Stockholm, supposed to be his last tour date ever. It's already the highest grossing tour in history. And Billboard says it just passed the $900 million mark in earnings, which no tour has ever done. But then there's Taylor Swift. Polestar says her current Eras tour, which just added a bunch of dates, is on track to be the first tour to earn $1 billion. That'll likely happen next year. Jason Athenson, ABC News, Hollywood.
Latest Federal Reserve minutes show some officials tried to push another interest rate hike last month to further fight inflation, but 11 voting members agreed to forego an increase. Andy Field, ABC News.
For Civic Media News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what you need to know in Northeast Wisconsin. A July 4th house fire on Green Bay's east side leaves one man homeless. The Green Bay Metro Fire Department was called to the 1400 block of Cedar Street last night just before 10 p.m. Crews arrived to find the house completely in flames. The fire was out in about 10 minutes, but is estimated to have caused $125,000 in damage. The cause of the fire is still unknown. Three children were seriously injured in a crash in Oneida. The Outagamie County Sheriff's Office received a call around 6 p.m. Monday evening that there was a single vehicle crash near the intersection of County Road EE and County Road H. When deputies arrived, they found all three children with serious injuries. They were taken to the hospital for treatment. Police arrested a 22-year-old Oneida woman who they suspect was intoxicated. The incident is still under investigation. Pete Schwabe, Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This summer, 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW has a new starting lineup. Starting at 6 a.m., The Mayor and Mino. Then at 8, The Earl Ingram Show. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crude. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show. On 1590 AM and 97.9 WGBW.
Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to The Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Todd Alba Show.
I've been pretty rough on the Joint Finance Committee.
I know what you're going to give bipartisan praise that they're going to raise the pay for district attorneys and public defenders. You don't get an attaboy for finally saying, we finally heard people cry uncle enough times. You either govern all the time or not once a decade when it's suddenly convenient. So,
but I think we have to at least give people hope once in a while that there is something happening in Madison that is a little bit on the good side.
The Todd Alba Show, weekday afternoons 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
app.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
The Joint Finance Committee, again in the middle of the night, took that out and said, well, hey, you have all this money coming from the federal government. Why don't you use that to create this program? Well, guess what? We proved it worked. Wages went up $2 an hour. There actually are a couple extra childcare businesses open now than there were about a year ago. And that's going to stop. Just Monday, we lost two.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Todd Albaugh Show.
The most elitist scorn towards average people exists within sort of that conservative far right ecosystem.
We're a couple of dudes who used to be Republicans. We were Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, Tommy Thompson, Scott Klug Republicans. This Republican Party you got now with Robin Voss and Devin Lemmyhue, the Republican Party at the top, want to start banning books, for God's sake.
Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Good. We will take what we can get. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember a couple weeks ago, the NTSB held a hearing in East Palestine, Ohio, on the railroad disaster there. And you know, one of the things that came out of it was just how much power the industry, the rail industry, wields over local governments. That the fire chief was given like 13 minutes to make a decision of really a huge consequence. And you could argue that, look, you know, this is a small town fire chief, probably, look, I don't know the guy, but probably doesn't have the level of expertise that would help someone make that decision that quickly. And they pushed him into it. And they used him, so they go, well, the fire chief decided to do it. That's how this game works. And I'm glad they brought that up, and I'm glad it became public. And I hope the NTSB comes out with their final report and puts blame where it belongs. But I want to talk a little bit more about that hearing. That's why I've asked John Russell to come talk with us. John is the owner and editor of the Holler newsletter. You can find that at theholler.co. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks, Rick. Good to be on the show again.
So tell me about this. You were at the hearing. Tell me, what did you see? For me, the big bit was that fire chief. What caught your attention?
Yeah, what caught my attention was a chart. And this was a chart about temperature on one of the cars that Norfolk Southern was looking at. And just to rewind, when you go back to East Palestine, we all remember the mushroom cloud. But at the time, we were being told that we have got to blow up these cars of chemicals before they react, they heat up, and they blow themselves up. That's what we were told. That was why the rush happened. And that was, you know, their justification. Now, they ultimately ended up blowing up 5 cars of vinyl chloride, which, by the way, is close to 1 million pounds of this stuff. It causes cancer. We all know what happened when we set it on fire. Now, they said that one car was heating up, right? What we found out at this hearing was a temperature chart that showed this one concerning car, not only was it not heating up, it had stabilized. It had been cooling down for more than 12 hours leading up to when they blew it up and was stable at the time that they blew it up. And Norfolk Southern knew about that data. It wasn't close to the threshold of where a runaway reaction could happen. It was, you know, heated. But we later found out not close to the point of a runaway reaction. So to me, that was the big data point. And that, you know, raises the question also, this was just the one concerning car, right? So they added four more cars that, because of this temperature data, we now know were never a concern. They were not heating up. They were not polymerizing. Yet at the last moment before these cars were blown up, they added 700,000 more pounds of vinyl chloride to the equation without reconsidering the evacuation zone. And they knew that the cars were cooling off.
The other part that caught my attention on this is evidently the company that produced this product was saying, no, you don't, you've got this wrong. That's not how this product reacts. That there was another part of this that was complete, that was never even considered, as I understand, and you correct me if I'm wrong, and that was never presented to this fire chief.
That's right. I mean, you see this multi-billion dollar company taking the fire chief. I mean, the fire chief was making the point that most of his guys are volunteer. Everybody else is working, you know, separate jobs here. The mayor of the town has a job at the stone quarry. I mean, this is a sleepy rural town, and here's a multi-billion dollar corporation saying, oh, the fire chief, you know, train crashes in his town. You got 13 minutes. It's him that made the decision to blow up nearly a million pounds of the toxic chemical. It just doesn't pass the smell test. But then you start to put together the testimony from other experts. And I'm thinking of Randy Padfield here. This is a 9/11 first responder, in the Pennsylvania Department of Emergency Management. A lot of credibility. The governor of Pennsylvania, all saying that Norfolk Southern, from the time they arrived on the scene, was acting alone, mostly, was kind of cornered off and was coming up with their own plans, was not clear about communication to the rest of Unified Command, and at the last moment was presenting the only option they said that was on the table, and forcing everybody to go with it. That's the window into this decision-making that we learned about through these NTSB hearings. And in that decision-making, we found out the company that owned the chemicals, who could have told Norfolk Southern that they were nowhere close to runaway polymerization, the whole reason these things had to be blown up, they weren't even included and didn't share that information because of the unilateral decision-making by Norfolk Southern.
And their 200 years of experience. I remember that being their talking.
Oh, yeah.
We got over 200 years of experience in making bad decisions. So what does this mean for the town of East Palestine? Because look, as you pointed out, they blew up, they burned a million pounds of this stuff into their air, into their homes, into the ground, into the water supply, all of this. What's it going to mean for these people, you know, today, 5 years, 10 years from now? Do we have any idea?
That's the most tragic part about it. I think we're going to find out over the course of years. And unfortunately, you can stack these disasters up right next to each other. 2 hours down the river is the DuPont plant, where, you know, a much larger scale disaster was put on to the public there by a company that knew a lot more than they let on. And everybody in the region ends up kind of being a guinea pig to see what happens over 20 years. And unfortunately, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube or the vinyl chloride back in the rail car. And we're going to find out what happens. And it's going to take a long time to do that.
Now, what can the NTSB do after this hearing? I know they had a very public display. And let me ask you that. You know, how normal is that? How prevalent is having this kind of a public display, this kind of a public hearing in a community? Is this for the NTSB? I can't remember them doing this before, but is this something normal?
Yeah, I'm no expert on the NTSB, but I agree with that. I think this is a rare occasion to see kind of the full power of government. We're talking federal government, high bigwigs here, moved to the town of East Palestine to make these hearings public and keep this in the news. And I think, you know, that's a good thing. It's this disaster, if any positive can come from it, it's that we use it as a window into how business is done by the largest companies in America. You mentioned the 200 years of experience line that Norfolk Southern used to put pressure on people to go with their plan. It sounds an awful lot like Wall Street banks back in 2008 saying, hey, the nice economy you have here, it'd be a shame if your own lack of expertise messed it all up. Well, why don't you leave it to us to regulate? Well, we know how that turned out.
So let me ask you this, because I've got my thoughts, and I've had guests on who have given their thoughts. Why'd they blow it? I mean, if it didn't need to be done, if it wasn't heating up, if it wasn't a risk, why do this? Why create that image? Why burn this stuff in this community?
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody truly does know that, but Norfolk Southern. But, you know, we can, as ordinary observers, we can put together what we know to be true. Now we know that they had data that showed that this car was not cooling off at the same time that they were rushing to blow it up for the possibility that it was heating up. They knew that it wasn't. Well, this is the same company that immediately laid new tracks over this disaster site and ran trains through the ground zero 3 minutes after the evacuation order lifted. Okay, they're clearly in a rush to keep this main line, this thoroughfare, this choke point of the rails open. Time is money. These companies are, you know, pushing for precision scheduled railroad and whittling down seconds of every process. They've demonstrated that they're concerned to get this rail line open. And I think when you stack that up against other behavior, it begs the question, were you trying to blow these up to get it out of the way quick under the guise that these chemicals were going to blow up if you didn't do it first? We now know that that wasn't going to happen, but why did they do it? I think we're owed that answer.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with John Russell. John's the owner and editor of the Holler newsletter. You can find that at theholler.co. We'll get links out in social media. The Holler, class politics for rednecks and hippies. Theholler.co, the website. You know, but what do you say to the argument? And I had someone email me this the night I talked about it. What do you say about, you know, this? They just made an honest mistake. They thought they were doing the right thing. The benefit of the doubt. Hey, you know, the disaster would have been so much worse had we not blown it up. This was the least deadly of options. What do you say to that argument?
I raise a lot of missteps that they had in considering alternatives. I mean, derailments are happening all of the time. What makes this one unique over every other derailment involving a hazardous chemical that there had to be a rush to judgment to immediately go with the most catastrophic option, especially now that we know that they were viewing data that said, hey, it might not be that urgent, right? First of all, the big question, remember, they blew up five cars. We were talking about one car that was concerning. All of a sudden, they had four cars at the end that they knew never did go through a spike in heat. What's up with that? The emergency response guidebook says, whenever a vinyl chloride tanker derails and is exposed to fire, you have to have a 1 mile evacuation zone in all directions per car. There are five cars blowing up with a 1 mile evacuation zone. What gives with that? There are all of these details when you really look into it that appear to tell the story of a large company that was in a rush to get this railroad back up and running.
Yeah. So let me ask you, you've been to East Palestine, you've seen these people who have to live here. This is their home. You know, what's the sense, what's the feel on the ground with people? What, you know, are, you know, what's the sense of what the future is going to be there?
You know, there's a lot of people in town. People are really proud of these, you know, small towns that kind of stay out of the news. They like it that way. They want it to be that way. A lot of people are, you know, hoping that this town can return to normal. And the tragedy of that is that it's going to be really hard because of a thing that's not in their control. I think there's a big feeling of, you know, this was put upon us by people that we don't really know how to hold accountable, because all of the other examples for industrial tragedies, the most you can expect for accountability is a fine on these companies that's just a cost of doing business. Yeah. These are multi-billion dollar companies that are critical to the economy running on time. Even the largest price tag is going to be hard. So I think there's a lot of frustration at that. There's, you know, sadness of, you know, a kind of idyllic community that lost some of that at because of something out of their hands. And I think a lot of people are hoping that this doesn't just turn out like another time when opioid companies, you know, kill off 500,000 Americans and don't go to jail, or DuPont poisons the water around here and nobody there goes to jail. I think people are tired of corporate malpractice without consequences that you would face if you lit 800,000 pounds of vinyl chloride on fire in a pit in your backyard, because you know there'd be consequences.
Oh, absolutely. So this hasn't even been discussed at any point. You don't think anyone's going to go to jail over this, do you?
You know, if I were a betting man, I would say no. It rarely happens in America. But I think something to watch there that's interesting is the movements of Josh Shapiro. Their administration has certainly raised or hinted at, you know, criminal liability on behalf of this company, especially now that with the data that we know. So that'll be a thing I'm watching.
I sure hope so. Last question I've got for you. This happened, what, February?
Yep.
We're here, what February is it now, July? Governor of Ohio just getting around to doing his job?
Yeah, so the demand from residents has been to declare this, you know, a federal emergency zone to get FEMA involved, open up resources, and do right by the people here to clean up this town and to test it and to really know what's happening. The fact that it's this late, it's like you said, do your job the first time, do it right, and not months and months after this company pushes you around.
Seems a little complicit. I mean, to let this much time pass before finally doing what you probably should have done right from day one. Just my thought.
Yep, I would agree with you there.
But John, I appreciate you taking some time for us. I'm sure this is not going to go away anytime soon. Love to have you come back and keep us up to date.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate being on the show.
Appreciate the time. John Russell, he's the owner and editor of The Holler Newsletter. You're going to want to take a look at this. Class politics for rednecks and hippies. TheHoller.co, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, stop and think about this for a second. The Ohio governor just now, DeWine, declares a state of emergency to get let the federal government in. Now, remember, if you will, walk back with me. Come back with me in the Wayback Machine. How conservatives made a huge big deal out of, you know, Joe Biden hasn't gone there and the federal government hasn't done anything. One of two things. One, and I don't know which is worse, to be honest. One, the elected officials who were doing this, the Marjorie Three names and that ilk, are stupid and don't understand how government works. Or there's the other one. They're just lying to you. they know what reality is, but they want you angry. But either way, still bad. Still not something you would get, you would expect to get from federal officials. Because look, we have states' rights. The federal government can't just come marching in. And I said at the time, if I were Joe Biden, I would have lined FEMA up at the Pennsylvania border. There would have been trucks waiting. There would have been all kind of resources there. Yes, you probably would have wasted a little bit of money and you'd taken a beating for that. But I would have lined people up. I would have media out there, saying, we're ready to go in. As soon as the governor of Ohio gives us the go, we're here. We're ready with resources. And, we're going to help, put up military tents for families to get refuge and all kinds of stuff. I would have had it all. Because I understand what the image is. The image of not doing anything, which is what happened to Biden and Buttigieg, is horrible. And Republicans know that, and they know that they can go to their minions and go, see, the Democrats don't care. No, it's just that Mike DeWine didn't do his job. Had he declared a federal emergency, the federal government would have come in and taken over. They would have sent everybody. It would have been, like any disaster. We've got teams that do this stuff. DeWine didn't do it. And the question is why? Again, why? Why wouldn't he do this? Because the rail companies didn't want him to. Because as soon as that happens and all the federal resources come in and all the federal egos come in, they can no longer strong arm a small town fire chief. They can no longer strong arm a small town mayor into, hey, we'll give you $5,000 if you just sign this waiver that you won't sue us. It's quite remarkable what these big companies get away with, and we allow it. So the question keeps coming back to, when do we say enough is enough? When do we say we're going to take these big behemoths on and hold them accountable? And look, as John said a moment ago, the reality is the rail industry is an integral part of our transportation network. It has been important in alleviating our supply chain issues. If that line is down, things are backing up. And understand that's the reality of the world we live in. So don't be surprised when this stuff happens. Time is money. Time is profit. So am I shocked that they strong-armed a small-town fire chief into this? No, of course not. Question is, how many times have they gotten away with it? Nobody was paying attention. How many times have they done this and there was no public hearing? Because I'll tell you, I don't remember the last time the NTSB held a public hearing like this. I'm sure it was the last massive disaster. How long will it take us to say no more? Because that could have been any small town. I mean, we've got rail tracks, where major trains go through a mile from our house. It could happen just about anywhere. And the fact that we haven't held them accountable for this precision scheduled railroading and the things that they do around, hey, we're just squeezing profits. We're just squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams. It's capitalism. It's how it's supposed to be. More for us, less for you. So when disaster happens, well, we're just going to externalize that risk. Knowing that they can tie this stuff up for decades. Knowing that they've got the legal ability to basically bankrupt this little town. Especially when you got a governor like DeWine who doesn't seem to be doing much. Now, had this happened on the other side of the border in Pennsylvania, I guarantee you Shapiro would be up and down them. Because look, I think Shapiro's got presidential aspirations. He gets the messaging. He gets what this could be politically. But he also gets the fact that, you know what? You got to do right. You got to do the right thing. Blowing up five of these cars when you could only really justify one. And even then your justification for that one is really flimsy. the only logical solution. And look, I'm not the brightest guy on the panel here. But the fact that you want to get those tracks open, you want to clear the route. I'm surprised they didn't just dump it, which is what they had done probably 50 years ago. Just dump it in the field somewhere. So what if the cows have six legs? So what if the turkeys come out with six legs? More be a John Madden turkey. Congratulations, we've just made a live John Madden turkey. Yeah, lots to do. Lots to do. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend J.D. Scholten, Iowa State representative, is going to be here to talk about child labor laws and maybe what Iowa's not doing right. Back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1888. That was the day that the spark was lit that touched off what came to be known as the Match Girl Strike in East London. The Match Girls were workers at the Bryant and May Match Factory. Matches were in high demand. The workers struggled under horrible conditions. If the workers were late, they were fined a half day's pay. For 14 hours a day, they toiled. The factory used white phosphorus that contributed to a bone cancer known as Fossey Jaw. Both Sweden and the United States had banned the dangerous phosphorus, but it was still legal in England. The plight of these workers caught the attention of Annie Besant. Annie was a socialist and women's rights activist who wrote for a weekly newspaper called The Link. She published an article about the deplorable conditions in the match factory. Outraged, the managers demanded their workers to sign a statement saying that Annie Besant's story was false. When one worker refused, she was fired. In response, 1,400 match girls walked off the job. Progressive newspapers across England called for a boycott of Bryant and May matches. From there, the women formed a union and asked Besant to serve as their leader. For 3 weeks, she helped the strikers with their work action and to negotiate with management for safer working conditions. The company agreed to hire back the workers who had been fired. They also agreed to drop the harsh fining system, but they would not stop using the dangerous white phosphorus. In 1891, the Salvation Army opened up its own factory, using a less dangerous type of red phosphorus. Finally, in 1901, Bryant and May, under public pressure, stopped using the white phosphorus. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
The political extremists demanding that government control every woman's personal reproductive decisions claim that they are pro-life. But that's a rhetorical fraud. Look at their overall policy agenda, and you will see that they are merely pro-birth. After that, adios, baby. Good luck. They consistently join Republican lawmakers to kill public programs that deliver essential real-life needs to babies after they're born. Consider child care, a fundamental need in any society. Yet, the leaders of our rich, sophisticated nation that supposedly treasures family, work, and children have created a mingy system that literally is a crying shame, revealing that our society deliberately does not care for children. Here's reality for you. 98% of American workers are better paid than those we entrust to care for our children. Working at a nail salon, loading boxes at an Amazon warehouse, flipping burgers at McDonald's are jobs given more pay and respect than most child care jobs. This is not just a poor people's problem. For the lack of child care availability, affordability, and quality is a looming crisis for a majority of American families. Nonetheless, Republicans, enabled by corporate Democrat Joe Manchin, recently killed funding for a program to both raise worker pay and lower the prices families are charged. Such care is too expensive, squawked the same lawmakers who routinely dole out billions in welfare to corporate profiteers. But wait, the GOP has come up with a genius, low-cost solution. Relax safety and educational requirements for child care centers, as Iowa and Montana have already done, allowing 16-year-olds to provide care for up to 15 children each. This is Jim Hightower saying, to support life, not just birth, join up with the First 5 Years Fund, ffyf.org.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm going back to this story in Michigan. You got this 16-year-old who was killed in an industrial accident working in working for a logging company. One of the most dangerous jobs in this country. At the top of every death, accident, horrible list for basically ever. And yet you've got a 16-year-old working in this environment and gets killed on the job. Now, I've had a couple people email me go, well, you got to learn good work ethic. No. Delivering papers, delivering pizzas, maybe working at the fast food place, cutting grass, shoveling snow like I did. That's one thing. Working in dangerous conditions like in a logging camp or on the kill floor of a meatpacking plant, that's no. And I look at what's going on across this country as we're gutting child labor laws, and I go back to what I said from the beginning. This is because we need three incomes to survive in the working class. And here to share some thoughts on just how bad this is and how bad it's going to get, I've asked my good friend, Iowa State Representative J.D. Schulten, to come share some thoughts. And maybe, you know, how bad Iowa has gotten. They're one of the leaders in gutting child labor laws. JD, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me. And you're exactly right. That's absolutely disgusting what happened in Michigan. And we had the same kind of talks when this legislative session, the Republicans wanted to push child labor laws past Iowa. And it got better than what the initial one, but it's still awful. And, you know, it's, we all know that it's just going to take a matter of an accident like what we saw in Michigan and in order to make some change about it. And it's disgusting. We now allow 16-year-olds to serve booze until 11 p.m. in the summer, and even younger, I believe. Like you're putting kids in dangerous situations. And I was on the committee for this. And I asked them, I was like, is there a difference of being at a bar at 4 in the afternoon, at 7 in the evening, and at 11 at night? And they agreed. Oh yeah. There tends to be a difference, but it's just absolutely disgusting what we're seeing across the nation.
No, I mean, that example alone, you go, you're really going to put, you know, 16-year-old girls around a bunch of drunken guys at 11 o'clock at night. And then hold them responsible because they're going to be responsible for serving these people. There's no upside to that whatsoever. And to me, it makes no sense whatsoever. But again, when I pull back and I go, this really is not about, you know, the caring for kids. It's about the fact that they need cheap labor. And better way to get cheap labor than to get children, especially immigrant children.
Exactly. And then that's what, especially in the meatpacking industry, what we're seeing, one of my colleagues went on a tour with the Carpenters Union to go on a job site. And he came across a 12-year-old kid working at a job site in Iowa. And it's just, you know, these kids should be in school. We want to, you know, when you talk about the American dream, it's not the American dream so they can skip school so they can work and help in that way. It's so frustrating because you see who's behind at least the bill in Iowa. It was a billionaire from Florida, out of state, a huge mega donor for Republicans that has a think tank created this bill, and it does not benefit our lives.
No, and again, this is just one of those moments where you go, I remember, I'm old enough to remember, talking to my grandparents about the fact that they were able to support a family with one income. One worker could support a family, and you could buy a house, you could have a car, you could take vacations, you could put kids through college. There was all the things, the American dream could be had on one income. And, you know, we destroyed that. And now it's for years, it's taken two. Now we're at the moment where you need three incomes, JD, just to make ends meet. And that means pushing the kids into, well, a bunch of drunken idiots at 11 o'clock at night. Because, hey, they need their booze, man.
Well, and I think the meatpacking industry is a very great example of when I was a kid in the 80s, you knew who was working at the meatpacking plant. They were the ones who had the boat or the jet ski in the driveway. They were the ones who were able to take a family vacation. They had the nicer car. And you see what a family now is when they work at a meatpacking plant compared to back then. I mean, they in Iowa, they went after the unions and they deunionized a lot of these meatpacking plants. And now it's just a battle to the bottom of how much they can pay less. And the pandemic spiked up the wages. But I mean, they're still for the job that they're doing and the consistency on like I believe in the early 80s, you were able to get almost $20 an hour. It's about $17.50, I think, you could get if you joined a union at a meatpacking plant. And right before the pandemic, it was still $17.50 four decades later.
Yeah, and there's no economic gimmickry. And I tell this story all the time when I started in the freight industry. You know, when I started back in the late 80s, it was 15 bucks an hour to start, top rate about 18 bucks an hour. Here, you know, 30 some odd years later, it's 18 bucks an hour to start, 26 at the top rate. And, you know, you're talking about a meager increase when inflation has gone through the roof. And yet, you know, I say that, you know, that happened so we could create a billionaire class, so we could have yep. the most prosperous billionaire class in the history of humanity. And it's because we took lower wages. We took on less health care, less retirement. We tightened the belt a little bit more, JD.
Oh, and that's, I think, a great example of this. I don't know how much you follow sports, but I'm a big sports person, and I know ESPN just had a lot of huge cuts. They got rid of a lot of staff and popular announcers and stuff like that. And it's not because ESPN's going under by any means. It's that the people at the top want to see a larger profit margin than what they're getting. That's the bottom line. And we're seeing it in every single industry. And I only use sports just because more people can relate to sports than maybe like a meatpacking or whatever. But that's, I mean, we're seeing it in every single industry.
You know, did you see Jon Stewart talking with Janet Yellen?
No.
He was talking about Walmart and the fact that, you know, Walmart is, and look, none of this is new. We've talked about this on the program for years. But Jon Stewart finally brought it up to Janet Yellen and said, look, you know, why is it that Walmart makes all this profit and pays their CEO so much money when they're the largest abuser of food stamps? They're most, you know, the largest number of employees use food stamps and social programs. How is this possible? And yeah. You know, Janet Yellen's response is, well, that's the capitalist system.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I was on I heard Stacy Mitchell from local Reliance, the Institute of Local Reliance today. She's amazing. You should get her on your show. She's absolutely amazing. She has a book out, but she was talking just about this, how one of every $4 spent on groceries is given to Walmart right now. And there's just the power that they have, the market power, it screws everything. And then now the Dollar General stores are the next wave of that. And you see them everywhere. Especially in rural America and especially in the food deserts and cities, but their projection is still to double in like the next 5 years. So they're not even close of what they're trying to do. And they're predatory. They're not adding to the community. They're extracting and they're cutting local grocers, local businesses. And that it's all policy driven. It's all policy driven. And so that's what I'm trying to change.
Yeah. So how do we fix this? Because, you know, I live in a rural community. There are Dollar Generals all over the place. You got one person working there. You know, how do you fight back against this? How do you save Main Street? Because, look, I talk to even conservatives who go, look, there's something wrong. Haven't put my thumb on it yet, but there's something wrong with the economy when you need two, three, four incomes to be able to support yourselves.
I think there's three steps. One, we need to start enforcing our antitrust laws. Right now, multinational corporations have far too much power. That leads into having like campaign finance reform, and which leads to a fair tax system, because right now it's get big or get out. And then the third part of it, we used to have a thing called the Robinson-Patman Act, and that was to protect local communities from invading or from like franchises coming in and taking over. And, you know, we weaken our antitrust laws. We weaken laws like that. And those are the things that were strong, came out of the New Deal, came out of the 40s and really shaped when we talk about middle class prosperity. And I know not everyone had prosperity back then, but more so in the working class. And then in the 80s, the late 70s, and then when Reagan came in, it changed everything. And I think I am hopeful because I feel there is a pivotal moment right now. Biden, his executive order was the first step in a long ways to go. He put in right people at the right places, like Lina Khan at the FTC. I'm optimistic, but we have to keep on pushing in order for this to happen. We're nowhere near where we need to be, but we're in, for the first time in my lifetime, I had a president who's talked about competition as being a key part of the economy.
Yeah. I've been saying for a while, you know, the thing that I love about him is we're running away from neoliberalism, and it's about time. You know, the sooner we can kill off supply side voodoo Reaganomics, the happier we're going to be. But, you know, you had Mike Pence today saying, you know, he doesn't believe that the rich should pay their fair share.
Yeah. I mean, he's in my hometown. Trying to run for president here when I don't know who his base is, but I'll just say this is that I think we're seeing a moment. And again, there's a populist movement waiting to happen in America. And I feel the Democrats need to do a better chance or do a better opportunity of jumping on this. And we are seeing some of it. I cannot stress enough how important that executive order was that Biden did. I mean, it's again, we need to go much higher and have larger hills to climb. But right now there's a pivotal moment because people feel it. People where I live have not bounced back from the 2008 economic crisis, let alone things we've seen since the pandemic.
Yeah. No, you're spot on. I keep telling people this, you know, there has to be a working class revolution where we take off the red hats and the blue hats and put on a hard hat to rebuild this country. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Iowa State Representative J.D. Scholten. I got to get some of your thoughts now. I guess you guys are having a special session. I thought you guys were done. You got a special session. What else, what are you now going to make worse?
So in 2018, the Republicans passed a 6-week abortion ban, one of the strictest ones in the nation. The Supreme Court just last month made sure that ban did not go into effect. And in one of the lines that they had in the opinion said, we do not encourage a state as in Iowa that would have the trash cans on the side of the road have more constitutional rights than a woman. I mean, just amazing. Wow. From the in every justice in the Supreme Court in Iowa was appointed by a Republican governor. So these are not liberals making this opinion. This is Republicans appointed judges. So now that they didn't allow for this ban to go into effect, the Republicans are coming back. The governor called a special election today that will happen on Tuesday. And we haven't seen the bill yet. But by what we're hearing, it's going to be one of the most radical and extreme bills in the country. And, and here's where how extreme the bill is that I have a friend who reached out to me today after I posted some stuff on social media. My buddy's wife, they had a child, the second child, they had a very tough pregnancy. And if that bill was enacted, his wife would probably no longer be with us today. If that bill was enacted and she had her, they had a very difficult pregnancy, and that's how extreme it is. Where are we with protecting the mothers? Yeah. And then when we talk about childcare, they're talking about the kids and trying to save lives and stuff and have babies. That's great, but then where's the follow up? Where's the universal health care with the kids? Where's the childcare? We have a childcare crisis in the state. And so what are we doing to address those things? And you get silence from the Republicans.
No, because they're just pro-birth. They want cheap labor. And I always think about the hammer. You may remember Tom DeLay, former speaker of the House. I was talking to a group, I think it was 2007 maybe, said, you know, what would we have if abortion was illegal and we had those 40 million babies? You know, we wouldn't need people from Central America or Mexico because we'd have all the cheap labor we need homegrown. I believe a huge portion of this is about getting those kids back in the mines. We need cheap labor. We need kids who are going to be able to go into those sawmills because they're small enough to get in there and clean out the crevices. We need that. It's good for build their character, JD.
You know, I didn't have the most dangerous jobs, but I had jobs that shaped my world and taught me how to work hard. And so it's very frustrating to see us go in the wrong direction. And it starts with labor's rights. It starts with women's rights. It's going after a lot of these huge multinational corporations and a lot of these billionaires who are just profiteering off all of us. And that ain't right.
Never mind Kansas. I got to ask, what's the matter with Iowa? Jeez.
I know we're heading that direction.
I wish you the
best,
brother.
It's not the state that I grew up. I appreciate it.
Keep up the fight. I got great faith in you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Anytime. Always a pleasure.
Good stuff. Our good friend, J.D. Schulten. I got to tell you, like I said, it's crazy. It's crazy what Iowa's doing. But understand, as he pointed out, the billionaire money. It's the billionaire money that's getting what they wanted. That should scare us all. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1852. The great orator and abolitionist Frederick Douglass was invited to speak at Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York. The speech he gave that day would go down as one of his most powerful. He asked the crowd, "Fellow citizens, pardon me, allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us?" Douglass himself had been enslaved. He was crying out against the great irony of celebrating a holiday devoted to freedom in a nation that still included more than 3 million enslaved people. Toward the end of his speech, Douglass asked the audience a powerful and resounding question. He asked, "What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham." Douglass went on to say, "Notwithstanding the dark picture I have this day presented of the state of the nation, I do not despair of this country. There are forces in operation which must inevitably work the downfall of slavery. I, therefore, leave off where I began, with hope. Today, the day after we celebrate our national independence, let's take time to reflect on those whose current working conditions and wages do not allow them to fully participate in the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. And ask ourselves, are we part of the forces in operation fighting for these workers?" Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. So Daryl in Minneapolis sent me an email, said, "Rick, I have never heard you address the Hunter Biden situation. One of my coworkers asks, how does a crack addict set up all of these shell corporations and do all the wheeling and dealing without President Biden and the rest of the family? I'm curious how you see this mess. Also, what are your thoughts about cocaine in the White House?" The cocaine, I have no idea. I don't think it's Joe's. I got to tell you, I don't think Joe's doing the coke. I think he's gotten past those years. Who knows who it could have been? A staffer dropped it, cleaning person, who knows? But the right's having fun with it, having lots and lots of fun with it. Now on the shell corporation front, look, do you really believe that Joe Biden was setting up shell corporations to funnel money? The way that the right has framed this, here's the reality. And this is one of these things where you go, Hunter Biden's a degenerate. He's a screw up. You know this. You know that every family has got one and there's always problems. And you know, as a parent, Joe is going to do anything he can do to help his son within reason. Do I think Joe set up Sheryl Cooper? No. Do I think he took payoff money? Absolutely not. And nobody has been able to prove that. Do I think people who have, oh, I don't know, a grifter's mentality? Do I think there are other degenerates out there who would use Hunter Biden in a way that could look unflattering to Joe? Absolutely. You see it all the time. Do you think that, you know, there could be, you know, business people, you know, good American business people who, you know, it's just about the bottom line, would use Hunter Biden and his name, knowing he's a screw up, knowing he's not going to know any better, knowing that you can go, hey, I'm going to put a bunch of money in your pocket. All you got to do is, you know, make it look like you're talking to your father. Yeah, I think that happens. As it happens with every administration at some point. Go back to virtually every president. The only one I can think of that it didn't happen to was Obama. Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm going, you know, what Obama, you know, there has to be one that was out there doing some grifting. There has to be a Billy Obama, like a Billy Carter. In the Reagan clan, there were a bunch of them who were figuring out how to use their name. Roger Clinton, remember him? He was doing stuff. You know, Bush had a bunch of them too. There were a bunch of these nepotism grifters who are just trying to cash in off the name. So am I surprised that someone used Hunter Biden? No. He's a screw up. That's what it is. But does this mean that Joe Biden's responsible for this? No. And I know the right is trying to figure out how to get their revenge impeachment, to get their grudge impeachment in there. There's no there. Now, to go on TV, to go on talk radio and make up all these fantastical claims and, you know, I know a guy who knows a guy. When you step in front of someone who's wearing one of those robes and you put your hand on that book that they think they've read, and they swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help going to jail and so help them God, then I'll buy it. But that hasn't happened. So I hope that clears that up for you, Daryl. Speaking of lawyers of ill repute, Lynn Wood. Remember Lynn Wood? One of Trump's, you know, top lawyers. One of the guys who preached a lot of untrue. You know, one of those guys who, you know, there was a lot of questionable stuff. Never went in front of the judge, though. Like I said, you know, they said there was a lot of there, just not there. Well, he's agreed to never practice law again because of his role in trying to overthrow the government and undo the election of 2020. He's going to retire. He's never, instead of losing his law license and facing disbarment, just not going to, just going to retire. Screw it. Going to hang it up. Not going to relive the horrible that was. And probably the smartest thing he's done. Also, Stuart Rhodes, you may remember him, the Oath Keeper founder who's going to spend the better part of a decade in federal prison. He is giving some advice to Donald Trump. Said you're going to be found guilty if you go to trial. So everyone's been demoralized and more likely to take a plea and agree to test a lie against President Trump. Here's the difference. Trump did it. what he's been accused of. He did it. Sorry, Stewie. He did it. And he admitted to doing it. That's the thing. His own words, he's not going to have to testify. No one has to testify. He said it in his own words. Yes, I had those classified documents. There are recordings with his voice in it. Yes, he showed them around. He admitted to having them. There is no test the lying, Stewie. He's guilty. The question is, what will happen when he's found guilty? Will he be Stewie's roommate for the better part of 12 years? I doubt it. I'm still going to stand by my position of he's not going to jail. I think he will be found guilty, but I don't know how they can lock him up. I just don't. Now, would I like to be wrong? Oh, yes, I would. Very much so. I would like to be wrong.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News.
App.